Well, good morning, students. Today we're going to look at higher criticism of the Bible. It's a topic that you should be introduced to. It's how modern science has approached the nature of the text in both the Old and New Testament. And so it's another one of our lessons where we see religion and science being brought near to each other. But before we do that, I want to make sure that you understand the landscape upon which this drama is played out. In your notes, you'll have there a map of the ancient Near East. And as Ezekiel says, the land of Palestine or Canaan is at the heart of the earth. And it is even today. If we look at east and west, it's kind of like the cross-section point. And so it really literally was actually a crossroads. If you'll notice, where Palestine is, in between the Great Sea or the Mediterranean Sea, literally the Sea of Middle Earth, and also then the Jordan River coming down from the Sea of Galilee, which is the only natural lake, the only lake in Palestine, and then flowing down to the Dead Sea, which is the lowest place on the planet where you can actually walk openly. It's 1,500 feet below sea level, and is extremely salty, more salty than the oceans. In between there is what's called the land of Canaan or Palestine, though some of the Jews settled on the eastern bank of the Jordan River. You'll notice that there is to the south Egypt, and the Nile River, the longest river in the world, is there, and it's kind of the lifeline for that place. When you consider the book of Exodus for next week, God's going to send plagues on that nation as he's freeing his people from their captivity. One of those plagues is going to turn that long river into blood, because that's the source of life for them. And they viewed it as a god. And so when we consider then the plagues, and there's 10 of them, I want you to ask, why so many? As well as the other question I want you to ask, and I'll emphasize it hopefully at the end, is also, what's so significant about the divine name in the book of Exodus? Those are going to be the two questions we'll lead off our next time discussing, Lord willing. So that's Egypt. We saw that in the end of Genesis. That's where they traveled down out of the promised land. Now, to the far right is where Abraham came from. That's the land of Mesopotamia, literally in the middle of the rivers. And the two rivers are the Euphrates, often called the river in the Old Testament, and then the Tigris. The city of Nineveh, the capital of Assyria, is on the Tigris River, and the city of Babylon, the capital of Babylon, or Babel, is on the Euphrates River. And Abraham came from Ur of the Chaldeans, which is the old name for the Babylonians. So, as people and kings and armies travel back and forth, and traders, you know, bringing their goods, they would go through the land of Palestine, north and south, because to the east of Palestine or Canaan is desert. And so they would go up the rivers in the Fertile Crescent and then go down through Palestine to Egypt and vice versa back to the other region. And so that's the playing field that we're dealing with as we talk about these cultures today. And we're going to talk about all three of them, the Egyptians, the Canaanites, and the Babylonians or Mesopotamians. Okay, now one other thing that we need to do is also kind of situate this in time. Your basic history tools are always a map and a timeline. You just can't get around it. And so with regard to the timeline, we're going to treat it in light of the promise to Abraham of land. That's a key concept. He's going to inherit or obtain this land someday. And they're in the land for a while, they're out of the land. That's what we saw in Genesis, right? The patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, are in the land. Abraham's 2000 BC. But then they go out of the land to Egypt. And as God foretold to Abraham in a dream, they would be down there 400 years. Now I want you to ponder that. I mean, there's hardly any ink given to it in the Old Testament. But 400 years, that's going back this year, back to the pilgrims. I mean, 400 years is a long time to be in a place. I can imagine how they might, you know, long have forgotten the land of Canaan if it hadn't been retold to them, right? Or had the writings, later on, had the writings that Genesis retelling that story. So they're in Egypt for 400 years, eventually are enslaved because the Egyptians are afraid of a fifth column developing if they were ever invaded. The invaders would join with the oppressed class and rise up against the Egyptians. And so they mercilessly enslave them, which prompts God to act. You'll read about that in the book of Exodus. They're in the wilderness 40 years. It only takes a matter of weeks to get to Palestine. Obviously, Jacob's sons did it quite easily. But it's due to disobedience and rebellion that God keeps them into the wilderness in between the two areas for 40 years. That's where God takes them as his people, makes a covenant with them. They become, as it were, husband and wife, by analogy, at the mountain, at Mount Sinai. Once they enter the land under Joshua, they're there for about 800 years. The time of the judges, and then it converts to the time of the kings. We'll talk about that transition. And then they are forced to leave the land again because they become worse than the Canaanites. And God destroys their capital city. God destroys their place of worship. And they're relegated to the land of Babylon, back where Abraham was from, for 70 years. 70 years is a long time, just like the communists being in Russia before, you know, like from the Bolshevik Revolution to the fall of the Berlin Wall. And then later, a remnant, not all, come back to the land under the leadership of some scribes, teachers of the law, Ezra being very important, some priests class, as well as governors under the Persians. They obtain their freedom for a little while, and then in the time of the New Testament, Rome wipes them out again in AD 70 and sends them scattered to the nations in a large diaspora. That's the history of the Jews in a nutshell. In and out, in and out, in and out of the land. Okay. Now, you have to keep that timeline and map in mind as I talk about some of these topics, both today and in coming weeks. Let's talk about higher criticism. It's an interesting name. It's kind of ironic. It's almost like the Enlightenment getting to name itself. Was it all that enlightening? Well, in certain respects, with regard to nature, but not in other respects with regard to philosophy and theology. And so, or even the arts, if you take it into modern times. And so, the name Higher Critics is kind of like the winner gets the name, what happened, and so, they view themselves as being on a higher plane of scientific rigor and of objectivity. But postmodernists would probably point out that there's a lot of bias. I'm not necessarily saying bias is bad, if your bias is, first of all, love for God and love for man. Well, the two issues that you would discover in higher criticism are dating, not going out with somebody, but the books. When were the books written? Date of authorship. And sources. What was behind the book that we see in the Bible today? Are there layers of other writings behind that book? I think Scheinlin tended to think like there was two stories of Job at different times. It would be similar to that, where there was the initial story of Job the patient, and then Job everyman was inserted into it at a later date. These kind of theories are taught in almost every college or university out there. It is so assumed in scholarship. If you went to most any place, and I had it even in my high school back in the 80s, we had a kind of teaching about the Bible as literature, and I think it even mentioned something similar to that then. This is so common. It's one of the reasons why I'm teaching this to you in the Western theological tradition. It's a big part of the last 200 years of that tradition. And it hasn't gone away. Critical views of the Bible, skeptical views of, it says it was written by this person, but I doubt it. I think it was written 200, 300, 700 years after that person. by a school of scholars or thinkers in order to prove this point, and then in revisionist history, go back and claim that individual as their authority. Do you see the kind of issues involved? So, there's a reason for that. The reason for that is there's a naturalistic skepticism towards the miraculous claims that the Bible gives, especially the claims of prophecy. The Bible is full of prophecy. It's all over the place. We just read about it in Genesis. God tells Abram, your people, your descendants shall be in Egypt for 400 years, enslaved, and then shall come back to this place. So, a scholar would look at that and say, you know, being very skeptical, that I doubt that that happened, or that, you know, Abraham had that kind of foreknowledge. And the reason being is that it's a miraculous thing. People can't know that. They can be good guessers. And so, in that case, of course, the book of Genesis is written after Abraham, and so we can understand somebody could include it there in a very naturalistic way, somebody might think. But the bigger claims of prophecy in the Bible are harder to explain away. Prophecies that include the naming of Cyrus, king of Persia, 150 years before the king reigns. And so what kind of insider knowledge is that? That the very name of the conqueror of Babylon is cited in Isaiah. Well, the way that skeptical scholars deal with that is they just say that that latter part of Isaiah was written in the time of Cyrus or beyond, and the earlier part was written earlier. So they just slice the book in two, and they have a Deutero-Isaiah, it's called a second Isaiah, that then would cover that part. Daniel, a book that I'll have you read in a couple weeks, is filled with prophecies down to the detail. I remember reading Gleason Archer's commentary on it. It's like, it is so precise in its forecasting that scholars basically give it tacit acknowledgement in its accuracy by saying it had to have been written after the fact. In doing so, they're saying, okay, we're not arguing that the book matches history. What we're arguing is that it was written before the history happened. We're saying it was written after it happened. And of course, if supernaturalism, a supernatural knowledge, is written off as impossible as we go into this, you're left with little options. And so the three areas of discussion where these scholars tend to camp out in are in the Pentateuch, the Prophets, and the Gospels. The Pentateuch are the first five books of the Bible: Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. The Germans have a lot easier. They just call it 1st Moses, 2nd Moses, 3rd Moses, 4th Moses, 5th Moses. Das Buch des Moses, I think. You know, so the Book of Moses. And, you know, that makes it really simple, but that's what they question, the scholars question that Moses actually wrote those books. Mosaic authorship is denied to the Pentateuch. In fact, the Pentateuch is said to have been written up to or even beyond the Babylonian exile, where some of the data was even inserted into those first five books after they came back to the land in, say, the 5th century B.C. Well, that's 1,000 years after when Moses lived. The second area is the prophets. I just mentioned Isaiah. Daniel, they'll say, is dated like 150 B.C., which is 350 years after the historical Daniel would have lived in Babylon and the Persian takeover. The Gospels are another place where there's a lot of debate. And there's other debates on the epistles in the New Testament and whether Paul wrote 1st, 2nd Timothy, Titus, something like that. But the Gospels have a lot of ink. And basically it comes down to theories that they were not written by eyewitnesses. They're written by schools of churchmen that are arguing with other schools of thought over how church should be done, and as they defined Christianity for what it really is, what they want it to be. And then as each group or each school argues with each other, they all grab Jesus and claim he represents our tradition. He started this. And so instead of viewing the four Gospels in a harmony, a view I'll present to you, they view it in an adversarial role as being competitors for the definition of orthodoxy and what Christianity really should be. Okay, I hope you got the feel of what this is like. It's a naturalistic view of how the Bible originated. I'm going to give you the documentary hypothesis, not because it's a big contender in scholarly circles today. I'm told that it doesn't matter what your stripe, liberal, Catholic, you know, conservative, whatever it is, whatever your background, that basically the documentary hypothesis, if you're a cutting-edge Old Testament scholar, is passé. But given that fact, it's still around and gets taught and passed off as if it's, you know, accurate, or this is kind of like the scholarly view. So I'm going to talk about it because it does bring up a number of issues you have probably heard if you have ever studied these things in a public school, or maybe even heard something on television of a documentary sort. So the documentary hypothesis began in the Enlightenment. The idea was started by Jean Astruc. I'm getting all this from an article by Duane Garrett, as well as other things I had learned. And so, but Garrett really summarized it well. And he basically said that the names, the original names of Yahweh and Elohim, Yahweh is the proper name of God, often translated Lord. Something I'll explain, Lord willing, next time. Elohim is just God. And where you find these different names, the idea was, the suggestion was, is there's different documents behind the text. That started the whole ball rolling. And so in the Old Testament, in the Pentateuch, did we have a fragmentary hypothesis? In other words, that the Pentateuch is a pile of fragments sewed together. It's a supplemental hypothesis with one main text and then augmented by fragments. Or is it a documentary hypothesis with standalone documents that then a redactor, meaning an editor, incorporates together into one big text? That theory was pushed by K.H. Graf and Julius Wellhausen, became the Graf-Wellhausen hypothesis in the late 1800s, and was popularized in English by S.R. Driver. And Driver is a noted Hebraist, and I still use a lexicon in Hebrew that he edited, even though it's 100 years old. Within that lexicon, it has all the J, E, D, and P's that are in Driver's theory from Graf and Wellhausen. You'll notice on your notes, they're written kind of top to bottom, J, E, D, P. This is the J, it's like the slang name for it, the J, E, D, P view of the Pentateuch. J is Jehovah, or Yahweh, for that first proper name of God. E is Elohim. D is Deuteronomist, because Deuteronomy is claimed to have been written in the time of Josiah, the king in the 600s B.C. And P stands for priestly, which is the whole book basically of Leviticus, as well as other pieces. And the P is said to have been written in the time of Ezra, after they came back from the land of Babylon. And it was written in order to build up temple worship and loyalty to the temple, coming back to Jerusalem and worship there. So, that's the theory. Basically, again, you know, the initial documents, J and E, are then supplemented by D, which wants to hold up the kingship in Jerusalem and the proper worship of God and the kind of backright history to support that. And P does a similar thing after they come into the land. These then are not historically having integrity, but are functional documents in their time. Now, some of the proof that was given for this are the names, Jehovah and Elohim, most famously presented in the first two chapters of Genesis, because Genesis 1 is Elohim. In the beginning, God. But Genesis 2 introduces the name of God, and the Lord God, you know, walked through the garden and such, and put man in the garden. And so, those two chapters are said to have come from differing sources. Okay, There's repetition. We find, you know, Abraham lying here, and then Abraham lies there, and then Isaac lies. And there's probably, you know, different versions of the lying story that have been incorporated together. Maybe something like Herodotus would do with his histories, having differing views of, you know, I've heard this story, I heard this story. But differing than Herodotus, who is up front, I've heard conflicting stories. These have just been kind of incorporated into one larger story. So they're not wasted. Contradictions. You know, where chapter 1 says, you know, God made man, you know, God made the animals and then made man. Chapter 2, God made man and then God made the animals. And so the stories are in contradiction to each other. Style. There's quite a bit of different style, and there is different styles. Chapter 14 of Genesis, I believe, is a differing style to some degree than other parts. And so that implies a different author. And finally, the whole thing is bedded on an evolutionary view of religion. And I think I mentioned this, you know, in our talks about evolution, that basically there is a view that societies have evolved out of animism, where every tree and rock or what it has a spirit, into then a pantheon of gods, into then a few of those gods, and then finally one God. And of course, those who bring this up tend to then extrapolate further that we are now not in need of any God to explain our world, living in a scientific age. And so this was then imposed on the Old Testament, that the first stories and whatnot of the Old Testament come out of this, you know, pagan background. It's something that Scheinlin tended to imply too, in his view, that there's a lot of paganism in Job. It seems like that was a part of his view, perhaps. Okay, now, Garrett, in his article, goes back through point by point of this, and then talks about each one. And his discussion's helpful. I don't want to belabor it too much, but I want to just give you suggestions on how to view these things, and that each of these is not airtight. Number one is, regarding the names, there's no analogy, he claims, in the ancient Near East to attributing a source, different sources to different names. That is a product of the fertile imagination of Western minds. Regarding repetition, the ancient Near East loved repetition, and the documents use repetition to emphasize things. I note in the New Testament, it's interesting, Peter's coming to the store, to the house of Cornelius, and what Cornelius had experienced, I think, is repeated three times in the text, showing its importance for the book of Acts. I think of Abraham's servant going to find a wife for Isaac, and I think he recounts what Isaac or Abraham had said, and of course that repetition drives home the point that later generations of Jews who get the book needed to know: don't marry Canaanites. It's not that they took that and incorporated that back into the text. It was there in the story, in the history itself, and it's highlighted through repetition. And so the repetition serves a purpose. It was very prized in the ancient Near East, Garrett says. Contradictions, this is a self-refuting. If there's so much contradictions, where's the editor? You know, you claim there's an editor that's stitching these together, incorporating these together. Where is the editor then, the redactor? Personally, it's interesting with regard to Genesis chapter 2, I remember studying my Hebrew syntax book, and comment was made on the preterites in chapter 2 that they could be pluperfects and not just perfects. You know, that God had made the animals, speaking that he had made them prior to man. And I'm sure there's other ways of explaining it too. Even summary statements in chapter 1 that don't necessarily imply a strict chronology within each day. The style, implying authorship, that would be very risky. If any of you are C.S. Lewis scholars, who would want to take any Lewis book and say, this has a different style than that Lewis book, it must be different authors, it can't just be C.S. Lewis. And so I do think there's some style differences. I do think there are some sources. I think Genesis 14 may come from a difference, from a source incorporated. I'll talk about the fact that there are sources. But I think there are sources then that were used initially when the book was published and were not like this large patchwork quilt given later. And the evolutionary development of religion is something that should be questioned in general. More than one source has indicated to me that this is something that is actually in reverse. That pagans and primitive peoples have often had a monotheistic religion, and it has degenerated in time to something that isn't. So, I'm not an anthropologist to be able to dive into that. I recently was reading on even Sigmund Freud and one of his colleagues at the University of Vienna had taken apart one of Freud's own theories based on the typical evolutionary development and turned it on its head, much to Freud's chagrin. So, these are some thoughts. You can get into this. Like I said, I don't think serious scholars are still holding to the documentary hypothesis, but this is what they do hold to. Almost so many, let's put it this way, many, many Old Testament scholars today hold to a naturalistic view of the text, to affirm its divine element, its prophetic element, its inspired element, is not the majority opinion. And so, when I told you that we live in a box, that box view of a hermetically tight, lead, sealed, view of the universe, that we just have to deal with natural causation, period, and not even allow the possibility of a God, even if he exists, to have spoken these words. It's that assumption that needs to be questioned. The Bible speaks of a very porous box in which God not only acts, but enters and speaks into. Well, to help you understand this, maybe give it a different feel, come at it from a different angle. Beyond even inspiration, whether these are God's words, these theories attack the basic historicity of the text and imply that the Old Testament is not historically reliable. And I want to just point out something that might help give some plausibility to my claims that it's historically accurate. Whether you even go farther and say it's inspired. Many people, and I had one student once in class actually speak up and say, and inform the rest of the class that these have come about by a long series of oral traditions, and you just need to be aware of that. This would be a common view, and certainly some cultures are very oral. I remember one missionary told me about being in Ethiopia, and a man had said to him, "Did you hear the speech the president gave last night?" And no, he hadn't. And the man went and recited the entire speech verbatim, 20 minutes long or something like that. Memories can be highly developed when there's no written forms, and tribal peoples that have no writing ability, have strong memories often. A friend of mine also had the same thing in Cameroon, growing up there, where his parents would tell him long lists of things to do, and he retained it fully. And his school had a lot of that element, I think, in it as well. And so, oral traditions, oral cultures exist, have existed. The question is, what was the ancient Near East like? And I was fascinated to revisit some of the readings I had been given in seminary and to see what was being claimed there. On the two sides of Canaan, Mesopotamia to the east, Egypt to the west, both cultures simultaneously, and that's ballparky, 100-year-ish kind of stuff, but from our perspective, simultaneously developed written cultures around 3000 BC, meaning 5000 years ago. And so Mesopotamia had cuneiform on clay tablets. And so these clay tablets were about 4 inches long. And so that's not very big. And the stylus is like a sharp iron point that would then sink into the clay. And maybe you've seen these little arrow writings, you know, little arrows this way, that way, and developed. That's called cuneiform writing. And they used at first logograms, which is kind of like our icons. We're getting back into this in the West, you know, where one symbol represents one word. But eventually they reduced that to syllables, and that cut down the number, I think it down to around a few hundred that scribes had to learn, and they could work with these syllables and record all sorts of data. Myths and epics, hymns and prayers, wisdom literature, jurisprudence, annals, chronicles, I mean, all sorts of things were written down on these tablets. In northern Syria, they dug up a tell, that's a mountain, and where Ebla, the capital of a Western Semitic empire, was. And the royal archives there, which would predate, I think, Abraham, had 15,000 tablets in it, with 80% of them written in Sumerian and 20% in the indigenous Eblaite language. And so, I mean, we're talking about a very literate culture. Even though it was hard to write, he had to go through a lot of training to learn it. There was a lot of cuneiform writings. And this went on for a long time. I think 2,000 years, this practice. Down even to, I think, Aramaic. So, that's in Mesopotamia. Now, in Egypt, you don't have cuneiform, you have hieroglyphics. And you don't have clay tablets, you have paper. Well, papyrus. It's a reed that they would then strip the fibers and you know, mash them together in like a woven, I think, whether it's woven or just mashed form, and it became literally paper. We get our word paper from papyrus. And just to finish off a little etymology, it was sold at Biblos, I think, and distributed from there in Phoenicia, and that's where we get biblion, Greek for book, and Bible, which is all it says is book. It's the holy book. It's the unique book. And so in Egypt then, they had those hieroglyphics, which until I think the Rosetta Stone was not able to be interpreted by modern man. But once it was and the code was cracked, we know that it's another written form. And they also were a written culture. And so there's a lot of Egyptian literature and they even developed a way to write consonants, where 24 signs were representing a consonant apiece. The irony of it is they never then bridged to an alphabet. So let me just talk about the difference between these two. You got cuneiform, which is syllables, hundreds of them representing different syllables matched together, and some logograms, icons as it were, thrown in for good measure, like you might throw a smiley face in. And then over here in Egypt, you have the hieroglyphics, which are pictures, though some of them started morphing down to consonants, not syllables, consonants, hard sounds. But none of them became alphabets. The genius of an alphabet is a symbol represents a sound. When you see the symbol, you say the sound. If English today had a pure alphabet, and our alphabet's atrocious, there's like, I think on average, 7 different ways to say the major vowels or to write the major vowels, each of them, long vowels. And I mean, all sorts, you know what it's like to write and spell English. You basically have to go through a phonetics class in order to get to that point. And at the end of the day, it's still just practice. That word doesn't look right. There's no rule for it. But if all 45 or so sounds of English were reduced to one symbol per sound, I bet that the same thing I see in my Greek 1 class would happen with our youngsters in America. Within 3 weeks, my Greek 1 students are reading Greek because the way Erasmus interpreted and the Renaissance interpreted those Greek letters, they basically made it a pure alphabet. This symbol says that sound. It's easy. It's genius. And we find then that even in the land of Canaan, a boy could write it. In Judges, there's a boy that can write. You don't have to be a trained scribe. The interesting fact is that it's in the land of Canaan. It's the Canaanites that first developed the alphabet. William Albright, an American scholar in the late 60s, published a book that had the Sinai turquoise mines proto-alphabet. In these mines were Canaanites that had been captured working for the Egyptians. They started using the consonants, I guess, of the hieroglyphics for actually saying their own language sounds. And I suppose that's the way I think it worked. And if it did, I can imagine that they were maybe coding from their masters or something. But that caught on among the Canaanites. Maybe some of them were freed or escaped, and it caught on. We have pottery from before the Babylonian takeover, where the Jews were using those alphabets, that alphabet for the Hebrew language. The Phoenicians are Canaanites, and the Greeks got their alphabet from the Phoenicians, and I believe that the Romans got it from the Greeks, and we have it from the Romans. So our alphabet can be traced all the way back to the Canaanites. The timing of that alphabet is in the 16th century B.C., 100 years before Moses leads the people of Egypt out of the people of Israel out of Egypt. And where did Moses spend the second portion of his adult life before the 40 years in the wilderness? He spent them in the Sinai Peninsula, the very place that alphabet first appeared historically, 100 or whatever years before Moses is there. To think that Moses wrote in an alphabet is historically plausible. The cultures that Moses wrote in and that surrounded the land of Canaan were literate, written cultures. They were oral to this extent. They would write down things that were important to them and then teach them, have their students memorize them so that they could be orally recited. But they were orally recited from a written text. It was written first, which is the exact opposite of the way that often has been conceived of a long oral tradition. We see this at the end of Deuteronomy where God says, Moses, I want you to write this song down. It's going to be their national anthem, and then teach it to my people so that they would memorize it and sing it and recite it. And so there is a lot of testimony for the interesting ways in which that writing first, then speaking culture, kind of bears witness to itself. One of the phrases that Bruce Waltke, a noted Old Testament scholar, said is that letters were read from written texts, and one person actually said, "Your tablet, which you did send forth, I have heard." And so the transferring of tablets, of these written clay tablets, even older written sources could be then incorporated into later written sources. The scribe who learns this text by heart escapes the enemy. The sage and the learned shall together ponder them. Father shall tell of them to son and teach them to him. Okay. I could give you some other data on that, but I think that gets the point across. Let me just wrap this up by summarizing what we're looking at with the Old Testament. Number one is, yes, there are literary sources that are incorporated into the Old Testament text. The Pentateuch mentions the book of Jasher as one of them, as it's written in the book of Jasher. And you find other chronicles and other things have been incorporated, much the same way our research papers would have long footnotes or appendices or inserted block quotations. There are literary forms in the book of the Pentateuch. Some of these forms are the covenant form is one of probably the most famous. Covenants are treaties between nations around the Mediterranean region where Canaan was. Took on a certain form. It's called the Hittite form. And I am told by scholars who've done a lot of work on this that Deuteronomy is not in the form of a first millennium treaty. It's in the form of a second millennium BC treaty. In other words, its very form speaks of having come from the time of Moses, not from the time of Josiah, 700, 800 years later. And that's strong testimony to antiquity. If we were to ask why was it written and then recited, we are given the answer both in Deuteronomy 30, 31, 32, as well as in Isaiah, the prophet, in chapter 30, that God didn't trust his people. I want a witness. I told you, you will rebel against me. Teach them this song, Moses. I knew it ahead of time that they're not going to keep my law. Now that's going to be very important for Paul's argument that the law was not given to give life. It had a different purpose, to give the knowledge of failure. Right away at the end of Deuteronomy, God says, I know they're going to fail. I'm not giving them the law of Moses, this Torah, in order that they would achieve life. And so I want you to bear witness by having them memorize this national anthem. And then in Isaiah 30, he cites the people saying, prophesy to us pleasant things. We want to hear good news. We want to hear bad news. No, Isaiah, write it down so that they can't change it. So just like we often will say in our culture, I want to see it in writing. God wanted his words in writing so that he could hold his people accountable. There's a strong purpose for why things are written, why the Bible, why the words of God then are written words. And finally, I just want you to note that the uniform assumption of Old and New Testament is that Moses did write. The law is attributed to him. I think it's even said, God even says words that God wrote. I think it says in Hosea. But the biggest witness to this is Jesus. Jesus says, if you will not believe what Moses wrote, you will not believe me. Something to that effect. Let me see, I'll get a quote here on it. It's from Genesis, or John chapter 5. Do not think that I am the one that accuses you before the Father. The one who accuses you is Moses, in whom you have set your hope. For if you believe Moses, you would believe me. For he wrote about me. But if you do not believe his writings, how will you believe my words? Jesus says Moses wrote. The whole book of Deuteronomy says Moses wrote the book of the law. And so, Mosaic authorship, though denied by higher criticism, is something that's affirmed by Jesus. And you have to ask yourself, if this is something personally important to you, you have to ask yourself, can you have your cake and eat it too? If this is a book by God, is it really necessary that I ascribe to these higher critical theories that are naturalistic in order to explain prophetic word? Do I have to ascribe to these naturalistic higher critical theories? Or can I just say, yes, Moses wrote the law. Can I just affirm that? And so, I hope you can see the issues. And so, just to be clear on this, I don't believe Moses wrote every word in the book of the law. The last chapter in Deuteronomy is his death. And I don't believe that he wrote that. And so, the law that he wrote is the bulk of Deuteronomy, and then it's framed in a literary framework. And so I find that an acceptable view, and traditional in the sense that most people would affirm that Moses didn't write about his own death, though he could have prophetically ahead of time. But what I don't doubt, and some of these other things you could quibble here, quibble there, but what I don't doubt is that Moses wrote the law. Jesus said it. Moses wrote about me. And so I want you to consider that. I hope this has been helpful and enjoyable, theories, and then realizing the historical and cultural background and the amazing nature in which alphabet arose in the very place and in the very time of Moses himself. Okay, you have Exodus, some portions of Exodus to read next time, for next time. Why so many plagues? What about the name of God, which is I Am, or Yahweh? I hope to begin our time next time with that discussion. So thank you.